This is an interview with Emil Mencius for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program by Stephen Evanson at his home on 4339 Timberbrook in Austintown on February 1st at 3 p.m. Mr. Mencius, what do you remember about your childhood?
I lived on High Street years ago, and I had an average childhood. I mean, run around, use a boy, and used to play a lot of football down at Bonnie Rogers Playground. Because we lived close to the park and stuff like that.
Do you remember what school was like at all? High school, maybe?
I went to grade school. I went to a Catholic grade school in St. Columbus. I played football for St. Columbus in 1931. And then I went to Grant Junior High School for a year. Then I went to Cheney. I played football for Cheney in 35 and 36. And I quit in 1937. I didn't graduate high school. Mm-hmm. I quit my senior year.
Can you tell us what it was like, growing up through the Depression years?
Well, during the Depression years, my father worked, maybe got one day of pay. He worked at Youngstown. He was a machinist. And we had food on the table. I mean, but we didn't eat elaborate. Like, we had soup and bread, stuff like that. But I mean, no fancy dishes.
You didn't get involved in any of the programs like, the WPA or?
No, I wasn't. The WPA was in 34 or 35. I was still going to school. I started to work in 1937, and I come out of high school, and I started to work at Youngstown Welding Engineering. I learned machinist trade after. And from 37 to 40, I was working fair. I mean, mm-hmm. I worked a year, maybe was laid off a couple months and worked, go back and work. Mm-hmm. Then 1940, when things started to pick up real good.
Yeah, speaking right before the war, though, what was the atmosphere like? Was there talk of the U.S. entering the war? Or?
Well, there was rumors that war was going to be, and people were scared. I mean, mostly the older people were scared for the young people they knew they'd have to go to war. It was evident that Hitler was marching clear across. He was going clear across Europe, and people kept the fear of that. Their sons would have to go into the war, go in the army. That's it was.
Well, were you drafted or did you enlist?
I was drafted. I was drafted in 1944. Actually, I worked it was all defense plant, 100% defense plant, but I wanted to go. I tried to volunteer twice to go into CBs. I wanted to go into CBs, but then they turned me down because I was on deferment.
I see.
And automatically, every time my deferment would come up, they'd renew it, and I didn't want, so towards the end, I tried to go, get out of getting deferment, but and finally I went in the office, told them I didn't want no more deferments. I was willing to go. So then, on December, they put me in 1A, and I was drafted on the Sworn in the Army January the 12th. So I went up for examination around the 10th of January.
Around that period of time, though, did you feel it was your patriotic, you know, duty to participate?
Yes, I did. I think because at that time things were, these men were getting, I mean, I talked to guys that had come back, and they were, I felt that I hadn't been in there, and I figured that at least I had to get into the service because I felt I was missing something.
Do you recall how your family felt about it after you got being drafted?
Well, my mother was pretty well. She was pretty worried. She didn't want me to go there. And in the meantime, I had planned to get married. And I didn't think I'd be drafted so quick. But I planned to get married in January. And the day I planned to get married, I had to go up for examination 3 weeks, or a week, about 4 or 5 days before. And then they took me to Cleveland for examination. I was supposed to get married on the 12th of January. Well, I went up to Cleveland, I think, either the 8th or 9th of January. And they didn't. They sent me right straight to Fort Benjamin Harris, Indiana. I was passed. I passed my examination, and then they wasn't given no furloughs. They cut it out. And then I told them I was getting married, and then they sent me back for a week. And I got married on the 15th of January. I was sworn in the Army, and I come back for 1 week's furlough, and then I went left.
Prior to entering the service, you know, how did you feel about taking another man's life if it came down to that circumstance?
Actually, I didn't realize. I didn't, never thought of it until I went overseas. Well, in basic training, they kept pushing, you know, giving you combat training, and told you if you didn't follow the instructions that someday that you wished you had.
This was the Army, right?
This was the Army, yeah. Okay. I was in the infantry. So they told us that it's either you be killed or you had to kill the other fellow. It's either your life or the other fellow. So you had to learn your training and make sure that you knew it well, because it might save your life sometimes. And I learned it, but after I never realized how valuable it was until I went overseas and got into actual combat, that it was actually you or the other. It was your life that you had to protect. And any man, I don't care how who he is, that he's going to protect himself. And that's what you had to do when you was in the combat. Sometimes you was hand-to-hand combat.
And you didn't, it was like a unit.
Well, see, how to expect, when you're in what they say, on the front lines, it's a column, you're in a cup. I was in a rifle company, attached to a rifle company. I was a machine gunner. I carried a 30 caliber water cooled gun. I carried the gun. My buddy carried the tripod, and I had five ammo bearers. Well, machine gun, when you go in, you're dug in, say you're on a drive or something. You're dug in, you're back, the rifle company is out in front of you, and they're spread out. And you might be trying to take maybe that house or that barn or something like that, that your enemy is around there. And you're shooting over the head of your own men. See? Your rifle you're a machine gunner shooting over, because your riflemen are out here in the front range, see? Mm-hmm. And you're shooting over top of your own men to hit your enemy that way. Then sometimes when you're dug in, you have your gun set in the hole and placement, then around you are your riflemen.
I see.
And then when you see your combat, the enemy coming towards you, you're shooting at them. Your riflemen are shooting too. In other words, they're coming towards you and you're firing at them. That's the way. And you had a... Then the average life, they used to say, was your life wasn't... They always try to hit the machine gunner because they want to knock him out because he was firepower.
See? Yeah, yeah.
Machine gunner and your VAR man, was that is not VAR was the automatic rifle.
I see.
And he was attached. He was in a rifle company. See? In a rifle. See, I had my training in heavy weapons. That's machine gun, 30 caliber water cooled guns, and 81 millimeter mortars. Mortar is a tube. A piece of I call a 4-inch pipe, about 4 foot long,
yeah.
And you set it on your base, and you set it, and it, you drop your cartridges down through your tube, and they, when it hits the back, down the bottom is a firing pin.
I see.
On the end of the cartridge is like a shotgun shell,
mm-hmm.
And when you drop it down, it hits that and ignites, and when that leaves the tube, and anything that strikes, it goes off. And you get your distance by tearing off paper, what we call it, there was like fuses on the mortar shell.
Mm-hmm.
So many fuses would be tore off a mortar shell for elevation. You had to have so many, I think 81 was either 3,600 yards, I think they would put for now on this. But that's the 81, that's the big mortar. Now, a rifle company carried a small portable mortars, which was 60 millimeters, I think they call it, 60 millimeter mortars.
What was the difference?
And then was firepower on them. I forgot what the yardage was on them. I forgot that. But then you lobbed them in. But you always had to make sure that you had tree clearance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, when that shell left that, if that struck a tree branch, anything right above you, it would explode. A lot, some of our men got killed by their own, they didn't realize they had tree clearance and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. While over there, did the thought of going home, ever enter your mind? I mean...
Well, I used to say to myself, there ain't a way you can come out of this alive. There's no way you can come back alive. Because you see men, I mean, when they throw in a burst, see, the Germans were great with their 80 millimeter gun,
mm-hmm.
And they could drop that in your back pocket, they had them on their Tagger tanks and everything, mm-hmm. And if they throw a pattern, they had a pattern they'd throw in. If one would land, if you're dug in a foxhole, one would land on the front over here on this side, another one would land here, and the third one would be right in on you. So you used to say there wasn't a chance. They drop it in. And
it was so accurate.
It was so accurate. The same way with their mortars. They was awful accurate with their mortars too. And they drop a pattern in. They throw a pattern of mortars in on you. And if you was dug in a hole, if you had a chance to get out of that hole, you'd get out and run. Because if they zero in on you, well, you would have done. They had your mark.
While overseas, did you, what was like some of the customs, and can you recall what like the, you know, the culture of the people were like, I mean, prior, you know, you,
well,
you know, besides I, combat?
Well, the only thing I can, when I landed in Naples, Italy,
mm-hmm.
And up in Maples at that time was, the Americans had come into Italy, and I joined the 3rd Division right outside of Rome. And the people, of course, now in Italy, in Maples, in the town of Maples, the people were all, they were hungry, and it was, the kids would steal off you. If you, like, I'll never forget, we come off the boat, we were marching 5 abreast up the road. Why, one little kid, maybe 5 or 6 years old, would be talking to you, and his brother would be stealing the sea rations out of the back of your pack while he's talking. And he'd keep you occupied, the other kids would go through the gun.
This was right after Rome had...
Well, Rome, see, the Americans were way up into Florence.
Okay.
See? And this was, I'm talking around in October of 44. October of 44. And they was, the Americans had, was up and around Florence, but Rome was an open city. In other words, that meant they wouldn't bomb it. The Germans and the Allies agreed that Rome, they would not bomb Rome. Well, that's, we come into the divisions, we come in to Rome, on the outskirts of Rome, that's where I joined the 3rd Division, where I picked up, then I went into training for the southern invasion of France. We trained outside of Rome, then we moved into the southern invasion of France up above Toulon. That's the southern part of France. And the invasion had already gone earlier into, like, around D-Day, what they call D-Day, the invasion of France. You know, the Americans come in at Le Havre, France. Mm-hmm. That's when they had that big, the big push. But we went into the second invasion. That was up the farther southern part of France.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the 3rd Division started, up through the southern part of France. We went clear up in the southern part, above France. There, we crossed over, Moselle River, way up in the southern part of France. We crossed the Moselle River. And then, if I remember right, we start training across we was in the Vosges Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Near what they call St. Di, I think it is. Here. It's right at the foothills, Kaiserberg, was right at the foothills of Vosges Mountains. And we ran into the Arab, the 1st French Army, or these Arabs were attached to the 36th Division of the American Army. They was up in the mountains, and we went in to relieve them.
Mm-hmm.
In the mountains there, at Kaiserberg, I think it was. And that was close to the Rhine River.
Okay.
So it flows here. And then, that was around Christmas. That was, while I was wounded, I got wounded and up and crossing the Moselle River. And I was in the hospital for, I think it was 4 days. I got wounded in the elbow. And on the 20th of October, no, November 20th, I think it was, I was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in a VAC hospital, see.
Mm-hmm.
I was in there for 4 days. Then they moved me back to another a rest, another hospital, what they call a rest area. And then from there, I was in Epinal, France. That was a rest, where they had this rest hospital for about a week, I think. And then I went back to combat on Christmas Eve, December 24th. That was up at in the Vosges Mountains.
Okay.
And then from there, on Christmas, around about the 28th or 29th, they had this big push. The Germans had this, what they called the bulge. You heard about that. They had the push all along the front, from Belgium on down, clear across the country. And we was a company, what we call the division in reserve, and we went in to help the 36th Division and the 1st French Army and near Colmar, France.
Mm-hmm.
And that was near Strasbourg. That's all on the lot around the Rhine River. Well, we started out just now about 3 o'clock in the morning. 3 o'clock in the morning, it was snowing like the dickens, you know. We started out on, we went in, we relieved the one division, or one company.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started across an open section, and the company, the men were coming out, we asked them how things was, and they says, oh, everything's fine. So we go in, the outskirts of Colmar, France, the village is right on the outskirts. We started in, and then our company, started to go through this town, and the Germans come in to one end of the town, and we was in the middle, and they sucked us in. And they started shelling us, and that's where they started capturing us. That's where I was captured, the outskirts of Colmar, France. And that was, I laid out, but they shelled us pretty bad.
There was no way for any type of reinforcements to come in and...
No. See, they had us pinned down. I was laying out, and all of it, we were spread out on this big, it was all like a plateau. It was all open country.
Mm-hmm.
And our men were all spread clear across a big open field. And the Germans started to come in the back way, and we couldn't, they had us pinned. We wanted to get into the town, the village,
mm-hmm.
but we couldn't get to the village because they had machine gun and mortar fire, pinned us down, and shell had, there was about five of us, we like strung across, and a shell started dropping in around us. This one shell come in close and knocked me out. I laid there. When I come to, I couldn't move my legs. I thought my legs were blown off. I laid there for, it was just getting, like daylight. And I laid there for, I'd say for 2 hours or something like that. And I could see in a distance like a barn. So I start crawling to that barn. And I crawled over to my buddies over there, and they were dead. So I start crawling the best I could to move my legs. They was numb. I couldn't stand up or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I just tried to, the best I could. Finally, I got to the barn. And after I got in the barn, I crawled back and I hear these guns were bouncing, the shells were bouncing off the barn. I mean, there was shell in the barn. They must have saw me crawling in there. And they start shelling the barn. And I crawled way back in the corner underneath a hay wagon, and I laid there. I don't know. I must have dozed off or something. I could hear men talking, and there's Germans. So I didn't know what the heck. I just laid there and pretend. So it was a German patrol, six men. And they come in and they searched the barn. They walked all around the barn. And they walked out.
Then there's one little short guy comes back in again. And he starts going around and looking, he's stooping down, he's crawling around on the barn, and he spotted me way back underneath this hay mile. Well, what happened? I had this white cape on. And you probably saw part of that white cape. See, we had these white capes to blend in with the snow.
Oh.
See, we was camouflaged with the snow, and I didn't have enough sense to take my cape off after I got into the barn. I left it while I was in a daze. So he hollers to the other Germans, and they come running back in, and they pull me out from underneath the hay mine. And I thought, well, I'm finished now. They're going to shoot me. So they told me to get out. One was like a squad leader. He told me he could talk English. Mm-hmm. And I had my gas mask. See, we all carry gas masks. And in the gas mask, I had about 3 cartons of cigarettes. The first thing they asked me, did I have any American cigarettes? And I pulled them out, and I told them, yeah. They grabbed them. So then they told me to get out, stand up, and walk. And I couldn't walk very good. I was staggering all night, because my legs are still bad. So two of them grabbed me by the arm and started carrying me. Well, I had a wall. They had a wall around this one village. Mm-hmm. There was one section there. We had to climb. We didn't go through. They had the gate like boarded up. So they threw me over the wall. And I thought, well, they'll shoot me here. Then they took me back to their regimental command.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in Colmar, France.
I see.
I was by myself, all by myself.
Wow.
So I figured, and they was moving out. Mm-hmm. The Germans was moving out. They wanted to abandon. They was on the move.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured they're not going to take me with them because there's only one man. So this here colonel says to these two guys, Germans, take them across the road over to the barn. Well, I knew what they was going to do then. They was going to shoot me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was walking out in front of them, and cars were coming. We had to walk across the road line. And the Germans were moving over their equipment down the road, and a car come, and he stopped. An officer got out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And he told his driver to get out. And he said something to these two Germans. I guess he asked them where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
They told him over in the barn. I heard him say the barn. And he told me, he said to them, I'll take care of him. And he told me to get in the car. And I hesitated a minute. He said, Bucksnell, get in the car. And the other two Germans just turned around and walked away. So he was a colonel or something in the German army.
Mm-hmm.
So then the first thing he says to me, do you have any American cigarettes? And I reached in my pocket and I had a cart or a pack in my jacket. I said, here. He said, no, I only want 3. He says, you need them. I said, I don't smoke. He says, you'll need them. So I said, I put them back in my pocket, and he told me, get in the back seat. I got in the back seat, and they took me into Colmar, into their regimental command. Well, they took me in a place where I had all these big maps and everything, and he told me to sit there. And I was sitting there, and in about 2 hours, he come back, he asked me if I had anything to eat. I said, no. So he went out and he brought me in a can, well, it was a bucket, like a barley soup. And I took, and I ate it, and he told me, eat it, because you don't know when you're going to get anything else. So I sit there, and finally, they brought in another American, GI, prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And I says to the young kid, young fellow, you know, I said, where did you get captured? He said, near Colmar. I said, well, what outfit was you in? He said, I was in the 3rd Division, the 7th Infantry. I said, that's the same outfit I was in. So he had just come over. He'd only been over 2 days. And then he was on the line. He was only up on the line an hour. And he got captured.
Jeez.
And he was just a young, I don't think he was over. He lied about his age. I don't think he was even 18 years old. Because he told me he had New Year's Day, he had dinner at home in the United States. And see, that's, they start shipping everybody over when the balls start coming in. They was everybody. They took cooks and they put them on the line. And anybody who could carry a gun, they shoved them up into combat. So he sort of, he says, how long you been here? I said, well, I've been, I think it was about a day. By the time they took me, up to the, one place, and then this German officer brought, I'd say roughly maybe, if I remember right, I don't know, I might be wrong now. Might have been a day or it might have been 12 hours, I don't know which.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they told us that night, they took us out of there, they took us down to another, there was some more GI had been captured. So that night, about 12 o'clock, they took us across the Rhine on barges with the horses right above the Aachen Bridge, which they was, the Americans was trying to shell it, knock it out. The Aachen, that there up above Colmar, France, was the bridge, the last bridge across the Rhine. See, now the Americans hadn't gone across the Rhine yet. They hadn't invaded, they hadn't gone across, and they was trying, we was right on the edge of the Rhine. And this was the last bridge that was open. And the Americans was trying to bomb it so the Germans couldn't go across the retreat over into their own country. So we didn't go across the bridge. They took us across on barges. And I'll never forget, I had, towards the end, see, you have to remember that the Germans, towards the end of the war, was loose. They didn't have no gas.
That's right.
They were pulling
tanks and
all, they was pulling their trucks and everything. They had one truck, they pulling five, they take the motors out of the trucks and they pull. One truck would do the work of five. And they was using wood.
Mm-hmm.
They was using wood for fuel. They was making, they was burning the wood into boilers and stuff like that. That's how they was getting fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So then, that night we went across the Rhine on this here pontoon bridge. And they were shelling, the Americans were shelling us. And I didn't know whether the horses would stand next to me. They was getting fidgety because the horses was pulling their carriages, their gun carriages and stuff like that. Because they didn't, they, like I told you, they didn't have their tanks was, they was only running their tanks, but little fuel they had, they was conservative. So they kept shelling them, and then we finally got across the Rhine. We was in a town of, I think it's Wittenberg. Wittenberg, the college where Martin Luther established his religion in that town. We went to, I think it's Wittenberg. We went to Wittenberg. That's where, then so they brought some more GIs in. Then by that time they had over 50 to 75 American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
We had this in this college. So the next 2 days they brought in some more. And all in all, we started out the march, we had over 125 American soldiers that had been captured in that bulge. See? Then we started out from Wittenberg, we marched to another, what the heck, it's a little town called, near Augsburg, I think it was, town of, we marched It says February 2nd, we walked about 30 miles and to a little town. I don't know. I thought I had it down here, but I don't have it. Then we marched to this town, Billingham. That's where it is. B-I-L-L-N-G-E-R, Billingham. We marched there, and that was an old military school up on a hill, which was used to use for cavalry. The old German army used to train their cavalry men. Well, they put us in there in this cavalry school. And then they had that was near on the outskirts of Stuttgart was about 20 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had us there for a while, and then that's where we joined some war guys. Mm-hmm. But these were Englishmen, English, and Australian
mm-hmm.
prisoners of war. Then by that time we had maybe 300 men of English and Aussies. Then from there, we was there for maybe about a week. I'll say roughly maybe 2 weeks. We didn't have nothing to eat. All we got was a little bit of bread. Then we went from there. You got to figure the Germans were on the run. Mm-hmm. By that time, the Americans had crossed the Rhine River, see, and was coming into their country.
Mm-hmm.
So by that time, they started to post. I was never in what they call a permanent prison camp. We was always on the run.
I see.
And eventually, we couldn't, our food, we didn't get there. The only thing, we got a little bit of soup,
mm-hmm.
and then we got some bread. Well, at Augsburg, or not Augsburg, but at Billingham, then we went from Billingham, we went to a little town of Ludwigsburg, a little town of Ludwigsburg. While we was there, in there, they have about 200 Russians in there. And they had this here camp on the outskirts of the town, and it was right near a railroad, a main line which went into Berlin. And then all the time, the Americans, a bright day or anything, we'd have the Air Corps would be coming over bombing the railroad. See? And then when they bombed the railroad, we had a go out and repair it. So this one day, they told us they had hit the English at night had bombed pretty hard, and they had leveled the town, the houses all around close to the river. They leveled them all down. And we went back a little ways, well, I'd say maybe we was about a half a mile or a mile back. So we could feel the concussion and everything from the bombs. And so that morning, the commandant of the camp, he was the head man, he took us, he lined us all. You got to figure there was Americans, Australians, English, and Russians, all in this camp. So the Russians, the Germans hated the Russians. So they do, the minute the Russians did anything out of the way or anything, they'd shoot them right then and there. They just drop them and leave them lay there. So they come out and they told us that we have to go down in the town and clean up the mess. So our group, the Americans, they kept the English and the Americans together.
Mm-hmm.
So we started down, we went down the street. This one soldier says, all right, he says to my buddy and I, or the three of us, you clean up the debris from this house. He says, there's a young girl buried in a cellar. And we thought he was just trying to jive us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we start cleaning up, and we found some potatoes stored. And so we was filling our jackets and everything up with these potatoes. So we had them. So pretty soon I was digging out. Finally, I was cleaning the debris, you know, like wood and everything and all stuff. And I run across the lake. And I need to put food on. Anything I have, I got sicker than heck. So the other kid hit me. He says, "Come on." He says, "The guard's coming over." He says, "Come on, get busy." He says, "He's going to hit you." So I stood up and I cleaned up some more stuff, and I was busy at that time. I leaned up against some stuff, and I finally got my bearing, and then I started clinging more, and my buddy says, "Here's the other leg." He says, "There's somebody under him." So we got it all cleaned up. Then here was a girl about 18 years old. She was dead, but I mean, she was a pretty blonde girl. So we carried her out. Well, what they did, the people who was dead, they put them on blankets, hot, lined them up, and they made it. Everyone walk around and pass every one of them. And then the townspeople were throwing rocks at us, spitting on us, they call us the American Fleegers. They call the Air Corps the Fleegers. The American Fleegers did that. Well, which we didn't have nothing to do with it. We couldn't help it. Well, we got back to the camp. They hurried up and got us back into our compound, into the camp, because we was with the. They was afraid we was going to get mobbed. So they got us back into the camp, and then about it was about a week later, or maybe not even a week, we moved out of there. They got us out of there because they was bombing the railroad so bad, they was knocking it out and everything. We couldn't do no more repairs to it. And the Germans wanted to get us out of there because the Americans were moving closer. So we start marching on the road. And we marched over Germany for about 3 weeks. In other words, we just kept continual marching.
They kept you?
Kept us on the move, see? Because they didn't want us to. So finally, we got to what are called the foothills of the Alps. At the foothills of the Alps near Augsburg. And that was a big POW camp. They had Indians, Muslims, Americans. They had every nationality. Oh, now, when I say Indians, you know, I mean they're from India.
Mm-hmm.
The big guys with the big turban, you know. And they was all, we had a column. They moved it, they closed the camp up. They moved the camp out because they had no food or nothing. Mm-hmm. We kept moving. What bread we got, and people, some of the villages we go through, people would slip us some bread or an egg or something. They didn't have nothing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept giving us a little bit. And then we come into Augsburg. Then we had a column strung out 10 miles long. All on the countryside, and we kept marching. Then one day, all of a sudden, four American planes come down, and they start speaking. We hit the ditches, then we wave in a white sheet, or white, anything white. Then one plane come down real low. We start waving. He killed his wings. In other words, he recognized was prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was around in April, I think, somewhere around in April. And every day, them planes would be following us. Every day they followed us. And then, towards the end of April, we was almost at the foothills of the Alps. A place called Ettringen, Germany. It's right around the Alps. So we was right outside this village. It was a little farm village.
Yeah.
And We was, the Americans, we was in a barn. We was out here in this field. We had been marching, and so this day they told us we was going to rest. It was in a big soccer field, they call it. And so we laid there. We just, the guards was walking. They had dogs. They'd have one German police dog and one guard for 10 men. And they had a muzzle on. See, and here's what I forgot to tell you too. When you're walking, marching, when you got to go to the bathroom, you go, you just fall out. See?
Mm-hmm.
And the guard would take the muzzle off the dog. And he'd walk back and forth till you fall back in line. No matter how many, every man, like I say, there was one dog and a guard for 10 men. Well, these men, these dogs, would, all the men would drop out and go to the side of the road, but these dogs would stop. The guard would take the muzzle off and he'd walk back till you watched you, till you got back in the line. So that's the way when we was on the march. And then we come in, these planes kept following us, and then this day, where we stayed in this field, why, the rumors was we could see, in the morning we could see tracer bullets shooting, you know, coming towards us.
Yeah.
So then rumors come that the Americans was about 25 miles away from us, coming towards us. And they was trying to get us in the mountains to bottle up things. But that night, while we were sleeping, I woke up about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. It was dark yet. And my buddy, see, we're laying out in a field. We just met, and my buddy, I nudged him and I said, "Hey," I said, "there's no guards. The guards are gone. The dogs are gone." "Oh," he says, "you're dreaming again." So pretty soon I heard other guys talking. So we all were, I nudged him. I said, "Look at," I said, "there's fire." I said, "there's gunfire coming towards us." And all of a sudden, there were shells going across their heads, machine gun shells. They were showing there was a crossroad here. Mm-hmm. The Americans were coming down this way, and the Germans, we was in a crossfire, cut in a crossfire. So we crawled. I told him, let's crawl into that barn. I said, "there's bales of hay in there." I said, "maybe we get behind the bales of hay." So we crawled into the barn, and they kept shelling the place like heck. And finally, the Germans kept retreating down, and the 12th Armored Division, American Division, came in and liberated us there. After that, the American tanks come down the road, first thing we all hollered, "what do you got to eat?" And we got C rations.
Mm-hmm.
The guy kept throwing them off the tank in cases. Now, so then we went into the village,
mm-hmm.
into this German village, and there were German people still there, and they was all excited. They wanted the Americans, because the Germans, they was all old people, more farmers and old people. They had taken all their youth and everything was in the army. It was all old people in the town, And they treated us real nice. So the Americans come through and they dropped off their C rations they had and everything. And they told us the rear echelon would come along. So finally, everybody went crazy. I mean, the men started to go here and there. They're out plunked. They want to get what they can find. And we had one SS trooper. And he was a son of a gun. He had one eye shot out, and they sent him. He didn't like it because he was put back from his combat to guard prisoners, and he was taken out on the prisoners. You know? And he was a mean. And when we were marching on the road, mm-hmm. some of the German people would slip us food. If he'd see it, he'd smashed eggs in my hand. So that I'd have in my hand, he'd take a bayonet hit me across the back with it or something. And this one friend of mine says, if we ever get out of this, I'm going to kill him. And I says, well, he says, I mean it. These other guys said, we're going to get him. And them guys went out. They looked for him. They found him. And they did. They killed him. They killed him. They come back and they didn't. See, life didn't mean nothing to you. I mean, you didn't, because you didn't know if you was going to live. But then after all,
it was just day by day.
Day by day. And then, after all the excitement and everything, the next day, no, it was 2 days later, we was moving in around this place. Like, all of a sudden, we got machine gun fire again. What do you think? Back in the woods, a group of Hitler's little youth movement, 12-15-year-old kids was coming in, and they start machine gunning us. We start in this woods. They was like spread around. They were trying to pick us off, sniper. And we had after all our trouble and everything, we finally got to the point where some of our guys had gone out, had stole some, had taken the guns and stuff out of the equipment that the Germans had left, you know. Mm-hmm. We picked up rifles, we picked up P-38s and stuff like that, and we were shooting back at them. And finally we got them, we captured them. We got them.
And they were young kids.
Young, 12, 13-year-old Hitler youth. And finally they come, we pinned them down, we got them, and we brought them in. Then, in the meantime, a lot of Germans was coming in. Some of the guys was giving up. The Germans was surrendering to us. Mm-hmm. They even come up, we didn't even have it right after, we didn't even have before we got the guns, we didn't have no ammunition, no guns or nothing. They was coming and putting their hands up and telling us they wanted to surrender. So we got them. Then about a week, they told us we was going to they fly us out of Germany to Rheims, France. Well, we flew out of I can't remember what airfield it was, but it was near. We went in these big what they call big pontoon boats.
Mm-hmm.
They would go on dry land, they'd go on land, or they'd go on the water.
Yeah.
They call them, at that time they used to call them ducks. And they'd hold, there was like landing craft. I mean, they used them for landing craft. And they would hold anywhere from 100 men. So we had about 10 of them. I remember driving, I couldn't tell you what the name of the airfield was, but it was an old German airfield, and they had C-47s, and they put 25 men in a plane to fly us out. And then we would be picking up, they told us we wasn't allowed to get no souvenirs, no guns, mm-hmm. no rifles or nothing. I had picked up a two P-38s and I had them hit. Then when colonel told us, he called us in there about it. We had them before we got on, before we went to the airfield, he told us we had to turn all our guns into this barn, everything. So I didn't do it. I took them, buried mine out in the field. And some of the guys didn't do it. They just took them. And I didn't have enough sense. They told us we wouldn't get on the plane. They'd search us. But I never stopped to realize they're not going to search every man to get on that plane, because there were a lot of men.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't bring no guns home. So after we got on the plane and we started to take off, the field was all bombed, you know, it was up.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the plane the other side of us started to take off and hit a gully and flipped up. So we took off and I was scared. But I wanted to get home. So we took off. And we started, we was up in the air, and we was circling over Paris. And I kept wondering why we are circling, why don't we land? our destination. See, we have pilot, co-pilot, and navigator, and the radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I could hear this. I was sitting up. I could hear the radio operator talking. And finally, they come back and told us that when we took off, we blew a tire out. So we'd have to come in on the belly. In other words, we couldn't land. The only way we could land was slide. So I thought, after she's going through it, I'm going to have to. So he said, now when we come down, everybody go to the back of the plane, rush to the back. When we come down, we slid in, and they squirted foam, you know, foam all over the field. And we come into Reims, France, the day they were signing the armistice. That, you know, the Americans were signing the armistice with the Germans. That's the day we flew into France, or come into Reims, France. And then there was a big, that was a big staging area
mm-hmm.
for all prisoners of war, for all prisoners all over Europe. Then you got to realize we had had no baths, nothing.
Wow.
We didn't have nothing. I mean, I hadn't shaved for 6 months, approximately 6 months. I had a big red beard. My horse is we stood in line. Now, this is hard to believe.
Mm-hmm.
We stood in line for a shower to get shower and delouse for 12 hours. Actually, we didn't stay in line all the time. We was in line, but then we'd take off. Our buddy would hold our spot, and we'd go around into the town and look around there. We'd come back, then they'd go, then we'd come back. You know, that's how we did it. We alternated. So we got up to the place where we got our hot bath, a shower, and clean clothes. And then they took us over to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we got the shower, they took us over, then we went to a hospital line, into a hospital, and they started examining. And the ones that was real bad, that was weak and everything, they put them in a ward. Now, when I was captain, I weighed about 170 pounds. When I was liberated, I weighed about 135 pounds. So I was put in a ward, and they fed me a little bit at a time. You couldn't eat much, because your stomach had shrunk, and you couldn't eat much. If you did eat, your food would go right through. You'd have the GI. In other words, you couldn't hold food in your stomach. I had an awful time holding food, even after I come back home there for 6 months after. It would run right through me. So we got from Reims, I was in a hospital up there for a week. And then they put us on a hospital train and sent us down to Le Havre, France. Then we was at Camp Lucky Strike for another week or so. So they got past, then I come across. I come home on a boat. I didn't fly out. But some of them, it always depends on what transportation they had.
Yeah.
See, they was trying to get you home as quick as they could. And whatever comes first, the planes were available or the ships.
And you're still enlisted in the service, though.
Oh, yeah. You're still in the service. Yeah. You're still in service. What?
Time to turn it off.
Turn it off.
Okay, following the war, did it actually have any effect on you psychologically, emotionally, or anything?
Well, when I first come back, I couldn't sleep very good. We went away. We went up the lake, and we stayed up there about a week, up Lake Erie, up to New York. And one night we had a bad storm, and it was lightning and thunder, and I jumped up and crawled under the bed and started hollering. They're coming in close. I started hollering, the shells are coming in pretty close, look out. And it sort of shook. I still remember, The storm reminded me of the guns going, a big gun, when it was shelling. And it sort of shook me up a little bit. But like I said, I couldn't hold nothing on my stomach until for about six months after I had the runs. And everything. I had frozen feet too, and my feet give me trouble because we couldn't take her. Sometimes you didn't have your shoes off for a week, maybe 2 weeks, and your feet swelled up and up in the mountains there, the snow and everything. Why they get wet? Then you keep walking and get dry, and I had my right ones were frozen.
Yeah. Another question. In your own view, how did your values change compared to somebody like who didn't go? Maybe you had a friend who didn't go, but actually did you
How do you mean? Did I resent it or?
Well, like, you know, did your whole attitude like?
No,
you
know, I know that.
You like. You know, you don't want to see food wasted on the table or little things like that.
Well, yeah, sometimes stuff like that. I made up my mind if I ever got back to the United States that I would eat. And I would, everything, I would have the best. I mean, I always ate good. I like steak. Mm-hmm. I made up my mind if I could afford it, I would eat. I always ate good. And to this portion of sea, I put all the weight back on. My values, I mean, as far as you say, anybody that didn't go, well, I figured they was lucky. They stayed home. Well, by misfortune, I went. And I don't have nothing against anybody that don't go. It didn't bother me.
What were the benefits that you received after discharge? Or,
Well, I had the GI Bill. I went that as far as I had a disability pension for 10 years, and then in 1960 they cut it off. When President Kennedy got into office, he cut off a lot of veterans' pensions, and I happened to be one of them. I was on what they call 10% disability pension, and in 1960 they cut it off. I never got it back.
Did you have the opportunity of going to school or?
Yes, I had the opportunity of going to school. In fact, I went to night school. No, this is when I first come back on GI Bill. I went to night school, took up drafting and stuff like that for about 6 months. That's all I used, the GI Bill.
After your arrival home, was there any like public or private celebrations? Or?
No celebrations, no private. I went to a fellow who lived next door to my parents. Why, he was a member of the Rotary Club. And he took me out to dinner at the Rotary Club once, at the Youngstown Club. I went to a dinner at the Youngstown Club with him. That's the only celebration.
Nice. Being that you were involved in the war yourself, what's your opinion of the wars that followed World War II, like Korea and Vietnam?
Well, it was a war fought for to keep the businessmen to protect their property. In other words, we went over there to protect the American interest. We had no business going over there for that. Because the businessmen knew what they was getting into if they building things over there. In Korea, I think we got sucked in again, the same way. The politicians got us over there. In other words, big business had factories and stuff over there because they had cheap labor. And then they turn in turn, the people got smart, a little bit smart, and they start rebelling. And then I think our government, myself, I think they caused a lot of the trouble. Our government caused a lot of the trouble over there by undermining some of the people. I mean, some of the Koreans, I think we had a lot of infiltrated people in there, mixing in there and trying to cause war, just, you know, unrest among the people. I think our own politicians caused a lot of it. That's my opinion. I don't know.
I'm sorry. Is there anything else you think important to add that we didn't cover?
Well, I'm trying to think now.
We'll take it.
I went out of the United States and I come back into the United States. I never saw the Statue of Liberty. I sailed out of Newport News, Virginia. And I landed in Naples, Italy. It took us 31 days to go across. It was in convoy. Mm-hmm. 31 days to go across. What do you think? We went on, up, come down through the Straits of Gibraltar, and come down that way into Italy, into Naples. Mm-hmm. Then I sailed out of Le Havre, France, to come home. Then we went over into England. Sit in the harbor in England for 12 hours to pick up a convoy, just come back. But then, 2 days out of England, they dispersed the convoy and told us every ship to go by themselves. So, coming back, we had the roughest water. I think it took us 7-8 days to come across, coming back. Now the Queen Mary made it in 5 days. See, that was the big, they made that into a troop ship. Now the Queen Mary, we passed the Queen Mary when it was going over. While we was coming back. Now we had 3,500 men on our ship. The Queen Mary carried 35,000. Because it took all the, I'm pretty sure it's 35,000. I might be wrong. But I know they took all the fancy stuff out of it and made beds all over the ship. Mm-hmm. They put that in service because that could outrun any German submarine. The Queen Mary was the fastest ship afloat during the 40s. See, that was a big luxury liner.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made that into a troop ship. And that used to make the crossing in 5 days. And then when the bulge come, you know, they had to get men over there in a hurry. They got them over there. And they was fly, they didn't fly, at that time, they didn't fly troops over.
Mm-hmm.
Like today.
Yeah.
Your planes wasn't, your transports, they used to fly the bombers over and stuff like that. But they never flew troops over like that. See? But, then we come over, and I landed in Boston, Camp Miles Standish in Boston, United States. And then I got a free, I did get a free phone call home. That was about it.
See, Mr. Menchus, I want to thank you. And
well, I hope, I don't know.
All right.